Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Dispatch 7. As always, I'd like to start by thanking you for supporting the show. I couldn't do this without you guys. I thought we'd start off this installment with some material that was cut from the last episode. First, a matter of uniforms. The standard infantry uniform of the Revolutionary Armies became an iconic symbol of the French military. Uniforms evolved a lot over the course of the 19th century, but in France, they remained true to that same basic design, blue jacket over white with red trim. All the way until the advent of low-visibility uniforms during the First World War, this was the template for French Army uniforms. Even today, this color scheme is preserved in the ceremonial dress of many French Army units, and in the uniforms of the French national team in soccer, rugby, and other sports. When the blue, white, and red uniforms went away in 1915, there was actually a lot of resistance from the Army top brass and the government. The gaudy uniforms were getting men killed at the front. That had been scientifically proven beyond any doubt. But there were still many who felt the iconic blue on red and white color scheme was too important to the Army's image to be sacrificed. And even then, the French didn't totally abandon the blue jacket. The new uniforms were in a color called horizon blue, a sort of muted, grayish light blue that was supposed to blend in with the overcast gray skies of eastern France. Field testing showed the German green-gray, British khaki, and American olive drab were more effective at blending in with their surroundings, but the French army leadership had a psychological attachment to the color blue. France didn't formally adopt a khaki uniform until 1921, and there were still reserve units wearing horizon blue as late as 1940, within living memory. There was resistance to the adoption of drab, low-visibility uniforms all over the world, but I don't think there was any major power in which it was more intense than France. Obviously, a lot of this nostalgia for the blue jacket dates back to Napoleon and the French Revolution. French soldiers in blue jackets had ushered in a new age of warfare. The French had been the first to excel at the type of combat that dominated the world between the late 18th century and the outbreak of the First World War. This had allowed them to humiliate the rest of Europe and brought French ideas and French methods to the rest of the world. The French were very proud of this legacy. Throughout this time period, the country was deeply divided along political lines. Pride in the French army was one of the few things that united the vast majority of people, left or right, Catholic or secular, monarchist or republican. They all admired the men in the blue jackets. So, with that in mind, it is perhaps surprising that in late 1806, Napoleon launched a program to abandon the iconic blue jackets of the Revolution, in favor of a return to the old white uniforms of the monarchy. Ironically, the blue jackets had never actually been very popular among the officer corps of the Revolutionary era. These were mostly men who had joined the army under the old regime. They had begun their careers, and in some cases fought in their first battles, wearing the white jacket. But it was more than just personal nostalgia. The white jacket harkened back to the glory days of the French army, to Louis XIV, who had dominated Western Europe for decades. In fact, to the men of this generation, the white jacket had the same kind of iconic significance that the blue jacket would have to their descendants. Throughout the wars of the Revolution, many French officers unofficially returned to certain elements of the old uniform in their units, even though doing so risked angering the government, even being branded a royalist. Shortly after Napoleon's seizure of power, his Inspector General of Infantry wrote in an official report, quote, "I have noted a universal desire for a change in the color of the uniforms," end quote. Only a few years later, the resumption of war with Britain and the failure of the expedition to Haiti cut France off from its reliable sources of indigo, which was the dye used in the production of blue uniform jackets. This combination of economic concerns and the pre-existing nostalgia for the white jackets convinced Napoleon to issue new white uniforms to two regiments in early 1805 as an experiment. And so, throughout the Austerlitz campaign, and at the Great Battle itself, there were probably at least a few hundred French soldiers wearing white. Apparently, the Emperor was satisfied with the results, because in early 1806, he greatly expanded this program to 19 more regiments, with the intention of slowly phasing out the blue uniforms. This process would take time. Napoleon's headquarters estimated fully reclothing those first 19 regiments would take 3 years. But, from what we can tell, it was their intention to see this program through, do away with the blue jacket entirely. We don't know exactly how far along this process was when the Grande Armée went back on campaign in the fall of 1806. It was only 6 months into a 3-year program, so presumably not very far. But there were probably at least a few hundred white-jacketed French troops at Jena and Auerstedt. So obviously there is a reason the blue jacket persisted and became an icon, and this flirtation with the white jacket is almost totally forgotten. What killed this idea? In short, the white jacket was a casualty of the campaigns of late 1806, which we've been discussing in the last few episodes. Part of the theory behind the white jacket was that it was actually relatively easy to keep clean. If it gets a spot, you just rub some chalk on it, and the spot becomes invisible from a distance. Simple. But in the thick mud of central Poland, the white jackets became completely filthy. Remember, most soldiers of this era wore tailcoats, which reached almost down to their boots in the back. The idea that you could just rub a little chalk on a jacket that was completely soaked in mud was totally ludicrous. There was also a grislier drawback: blood. Behind a white background, even a minor wound practically leaps out at the eye. The dead and the seriously wounded looked even worse. Even white-jacketed soldiers who came out of a battle unscathed sometimes looked like butchers, after being splattered by the blood of a comrade or an enemy. Some officers complained that these prominent blood stains made the white uniforms bad for morale. Napoleon himself was horrified when he rode past a white-jacketed unit that had seen heavy fighting at the Battle of Eylau. Furthermore, Napoleon now had to contemplate the prospect of a long war, and of maintaining long-term occupations over much of the European continent. The French army was facing huge logistical challenges, and the French state would have to find a way to pay for it all. Under these conditions, it was hard to justify a program that was largely aesthetic. And so, in early 1807, the project was cancelled. This provoked protests from some officers. As I mentioned, there was a nostalgia for the old uniforms among the officer corps, but more importantly, many of them had already spent money on new white uniforms, which were now useless. As I've mentioned in past episodes, officers were responsible for providing their own clothing, and a new set of uniforms was not cheap. But ultimately, their grumbling didn't amount to much, and the whole affair was quickly forgotten. Blue became the iconic color of the French army, and would remain so. Even today, if you go look up photos of last year's Bastille Day parade in Paris, you will see a lot of blue. I cut that segment because it felt like it was a little bit lighthearted for what turned out to be a pretty dark episode, and I didn't see where else I could fit it in anytime soon. I also cut a bit of the backstory of one of the Russian commanders we introduced last episode, Marshal Mikhail Kamensky. You might remember that Kamensky was the overall commander of Russian forces in this theater, at least on paper. In practice, he was well past his prime, and begged Emperor Alexander to replace him, in that somewhat pathetic letter I quoted from last episode. Kamensky's last job before being sent off to Poland was as military governor of St. Petersburg. The position of the Imperial Russian military governor was, as far as I know, somewhat unique among the European great powers. Military governors were in charge of the garrisons and had authority over military affairs within their jurisdiction, but they also took on a lot of tasks that we would normally associate with the civilian government. So the role of military governor of the national capital and its surroundings was important. During his tenure in this position, Kamensky was widely regarded as incompetent, so much so that Emperor Alexander himself fired him. Which begs the question, why was Kamensky then rewarded with another important assignment? The stated rationale behind the appointment had to do with the national divisions within the Russian officer corps, which we discussed last episode. The Russian army had a huge number of non-Russian officers, both men recruited from abroad, like General Bennigsen, and men who came from within the Russian Empire but had non-Russian national identities, like the Baltic German General Buxhovden, or Prince Pyotr Bagration, who was actually a member of the Georgian nobility, whose family had been absorbed into the Russian aristocracy after Georgia became a part of the Russian Empire. As I mentioned last episode, this practice of recruiting foreigners was necessary for this large army with a small recruiting pool for officers, and many of these non-Russian nobles from within the empire had strong military traditions and reliably produced good officers with built-in connections and mentors from their family networks within the army. These non-Russian officers also tended to be more plugged in to cutting-edge Western military methods and theory, and were an important conduit for this information to enter the Russian army. Russia needed these officers, but as I mentioned last episode, some of them were incompetent or unsavory characters, and there was sometimes friction between ethnic Russians and non-Russians. What I didn't mention last episode is that this practice of recruiting foreigners was not liked by many at the imperial court. In all countries, many aristocrats of this era were far more concerned about the privileges of their class and the fortunes of their family than in the so-called national interest. Many Russian aristocrats didn't care that these foreign and non-Russian officers played an important and necessary role in their country's military. They felt those positions, and the salaries and privileges that came with them, should go to native Russian nobility. In all his appointments, Emperor Alexander had to keep these feelings in mind. Russian monarchs of this period were keenly aware of the potential consequences of angering their courtiers. There was plenty of historical precedent for rulers being overthrown or even assassinated, like Alexander's unfortunate father. And so, after appointing a German and a Baltic German to lead his armies into Poland, Emperor Alexander felt he needed a Russian in overall command to maintain some semblance of ethnic balance in the leadership and appease these nobles at court, who demanded more quote-unquote real Russians in positions of authority. There was a general with the skills to command two armies and a good record facing Napoleon and a pure Russian pedigree that would have pleased the court. Prince Mikhail Kutuzov, who you may remember from our episodes on the Austerlitz campaign. However, Kutuzov had been made into a scapegoat for that defeat, quite unfairly in my judgment. He and Alexander had never gotten along, and the emperor was not eager to end his exile. Alexander complained, quote, "There is not a single general with the talent of a commander-in-chief," end quote. And that is how you end up with the aging, temperamental, totally unsuitable Marshal Kamensky, a man who the emperor had recently fired for incompetence, leading two armies against Napoleon. At least, that's the stated reason. I can't help but wonder if the emperor didn't pick Kamensky because he was so feeble. Perhaps he really wanted Bennigsen and Buxhovden in the driver's seat, and so he picked someone he knew would be unlikely, or even unable, to take control of events. I found this little story about Kamensky's appointment interesting, but I wound up cutting it because ultimately, as you saw, Kamensky did not wind up being a very important character in this story, and I felt our little digression about the makeup of the Russian officer corps was already long enough. Anyway, on to your questions. NSC asked, "As a scientist, I'm interested in where we are with regard to the international adoption of the SI system. To what degree did the sister republics and client states adopt it on their own versus responding to orders from the top?" For those of you who are unaware, the SI system is the system of measurements used in the sciences and in daily life in most of the world. In America, it is more commonly called the metric system. In this era, the new system was wildly unpopular, basically everywhere. Wherever you find the metric system, you find that it was imposed from the top. There were massive benefits to the standardization of weights and measures, but these were not immediately obvious to average people on the ground, who mostly just experienced annoyance at being forced to abandon their local customary system, which was second nature to most people. Some unscrupulous merchants took full advantage of the confusion. Someone who might be shrewd enough to notice when their sack of grain was an ounce short of the 2 pounds advertised might be fooled by a sack that was a few grams short of a kilogram, because the weight of a kilogram was not intuitive in the same way as the weight of a pound. So most people preferred to deal in the old system, and governments all over French-dominated Europe were forced to devote resources to upholding the new system. In 1812, Napoleon resolved to make a change. He was torn between conflicting impulses. On one hand, as we've discussed in many past episodes, Napoleon was eager to close the book on the unpopular and eccentric aspects of the revolution. He phased out things like the revolutionary calendar and official state deism, which may have made sense in the salons and political clubs of Paris, but were generally baffling and annoying to average French men and women. Most people would have put the metric system in this same category. However, Napoleon was very attached to order and reason, and had a strong universalizing impulse. The metric system appealed to this side of Bonaparte's character. It was rational, and the benefits of replacing the patchwork of local weights and measures with a new system common to the entire continent were obvious to any person of vision, particularly someone interested in the sciences, like Napoleon. And so the emperor compromised. In 1812, he announced a new system of weights and measures that would be a blending of the old system and the new. Generally speaking, this would be a resurrection of the old vocabulary, like pound, fathom, bushel, and quart, but with those terms redefined to fit neatly within the decimalized metric system. For instance, a new French pound was now exactly 500 grams, and a fathom was exactly 2 meters. This compromise quasi-metric system actually lasted quite a long time. France didn't legally return to a pure metric system until 1840, and the process of slowly phasing it in lasted for 2 decades. Next, Ed Scott asked, "Are you aware of any instances where civilians might have been able to seek compensation for deprivations suffered during the wars in this period? For example, if a house caught fire during a battle, or someone had to suffer soldiers being garrisoned in their barn. Are there any situations where the owner might have been able to go to their government, or a foreign government, to ask for help, or seek redress in the courts?" I'm assuming the answer is no, but would be interested if you knew of any instances. As far as I know, none of the great powers had any kind of centralized system or official procedure to handle these kinds of petitions. It's always important to keep in mind that, by our standards, the bureaucracies of this era were incredibly small and very amateurish, with very limited capabilities. It's hard to underestimate the growth in the size and power of the state in the 19th and 20th centuries. Like many things in this era, these matters were handled on a case-by-case, ad hoc basis. If you were a victim of the circumstances of war, it was up to you to make a petition to some person in authority. Whether or not you received compensation, and how much or what form it took, would depend on your ability to plead your case and lean on your connections, and on the goodwill of whoever you were petitioning. Unfortunately, this usually meant that the rich and powerful, those least likely to need compensation, were often the likeliest to get it. Let's take one unusual example of how this system could work, or not work. This is the story of an English merchant named John Bellingham. Bellingham had gotten himself involved in a bad business deal in Russia. To make a long story short, A combination of bad luck, a lack of common sense, and an obstinate attitude had seen him locked up in a Russian debtor's prison. He spent nearly 5 years in captivity before finally being allowed to return to England. This was an unusually long stay, and the circumstances of the war probably had something to do with the delay. Upon his return, Bellingham began petitioning the government for some kind of compensation. This was practically a full-time job. He moved to London and didn't work, relying on his wife to support their family. Bellingham spent his days in the waiting rooms of members of parliament and government ministries. He got nowhere. Bellingham had a sad story to tell, but he had no real connections. His case was only tangentially related to the war, and he had no real legal or even logical argument as to how the British government shared any responsibility for his suffering. On April 18, 1812, Bellingham was able to get a meeting with an official from the Treasury. After being rejected again, he told the Treasury man that he was ready to take justice into his own hands. Less than a month later, on May 11th, Bellingham showed up at the lobby of the House of Commons. By now, he was a familiar sight around government offices, and no one thought twice about it. At around 5:15 in the evening, Prime Minister Spencer Percival arrived at the Houses of Parliament. Bellingham approached him, drew a pistol from inside his jacket, and shot Percival in the chest, then calmly sat down on a bench and waited to be arrested. By the time a doctor arrived to treat the Prime Minister, he was dead. Spencer Percival remains the only British Prime Minister to have been assassinated in office. It has been suggested that Bellingham may have been acting as part of a larger conspiracy, but no evidence for this theory has ever emerged. Bellingham's lawyers tried to plead insanity, but he maintained that he was sane and his actions were justified in the face of the government's indifference to his rightful petitions. John Bellingham was executed May 18, 1812, just a week after the assassination. It's a strange story, and you can't help but wonder if a more standardized and universal system of compensation for war victims might have spared Percival this undignified end. Next, Martin Murphy asked, "Is there anything you have missed in the overall narrative that you now wish you had included?" If I tried to list every time this has happened in the whole course of the show, this dispatch would be about 4 hours long. Every episode has something I wish I'd put in, or that I'd gone into more detail on, or some interesting anecdote or quotation that would have fit perfectly, but I only discovered later in subsequent research. When I first started, this really bothered me. I felt like I was not putting out my best work and letting you guys down, and I would resolve to read more for the next episode to make sure it never happened again. But no matter how hard I worked, it just kept happening. Eventually, I came to accept that this is simply a part of the process. Book authors have the luxury of going back and editing chapters they've already written. Podcasters do not. That's all for now. I'll be back to you soon with more from the campaign in Poland. Until then, thank you for your support.